And now, Future Theater with Bill and Nancy Burns on the Inception Radio Network.
This is Future Theater Radio, live, coming to you from the babbling banks of Primrose Creek in beautiful downtown Solbury, Pennsylvania, with your hosts, Bill, that's me, and Nancy.
Yep, I'm here. Yes, Burns. Windy. Windy tonight.
When it's a torrent of wind like this, it really kind of upsets everything because there are branches flying around and, you know, treetops that are swaying and, you know, just it's amazing driving on the roads here. It's so rural. And what you see are these branches flying by your windshield because they've all been degraded, weakened from the ice storms we've been having. And now they're just flying around. Lots of kindling, lots of good kindling brush, but boy, I'll tell you, it's a lot of cleanup to do from these windstorms.
Tonight's show is going to be so weird, and the wind kind of adds to the atmosphere. We bring up the wind because if we suddenly snap off the air, it will be for one of two reasons. One, it might be the wind, but two, it might be, you know, the powers that be, because tonight's show... My goodness, if the fellow we have on, and we've codenamed him Viper, if he is telling the truth, and that's the big if, get ready to have your world rocked and rolled, because he's going to tell you that the government has so many saucers captured. He knows it for a fact because he has helped capture them, etc. If this is the truth, it's an amazing truth. So, and this whole thing's going to become very, very spooky, I guarantee, because my job is to figure out if he's telling the truth, and second, my second job is to keep myself from getting too scared, because, you know, if he's telling the truth, are we all going to be, you know, in danger?
Well, the big thing is this, that this all began with a very interesting conversation with an email that he'd sent me about the reason nobody can find Area 51 or do much research in Freedom of Information is that the area is not cataloged in the official Air Force files as Area 51. That's a name that it was given. He said, if you want to look for things happening at bases that actually have names, look for Nellis Air Force Base, look for Groom Lake, look for Papoose Lake. There you'll find the stuff you need to find. So that was interesting. And
we all knew that already. That's not really earth-shaking. Right. He just simply felt that you... and I on the radio show and you on the TV show were kind of looking foolish by using the name Area 51 all the time. And he simply, you know, as a good Samaritan type, simply wanted to set the record straight and said, if you want to chat, he was willing to chat. And, of course, we took him up on it. And as I said, if he's telling the truth, it's freaky. If he's not telling the truth, then he's one of many, many, many people who... are out to scam us, you know.
Now tonight,
or the government sets on us to send us the wrong way.
Well, yeah. What I want to do.
Yeah. And hi to the chat room, and hi to Jamie. And no, his voice is not masked. That's what freaks me out. He does sound sick. He is in fact sick with some. It sounds like a radiation type of sickness. He is a first-hand source, like you would not believe. Is he brave? Is he allowed to talk? We have to find out tonight. But anyway, well, I wanted to also... I'll just lead the...
No, go ahead. I want to... Yeah.
I wanted to just talk about a couple things. One was last week, this week just passed, we went to New York City and had a fabulous time at a thing in New York City. It was a night of... it's called Pitch, P-I-T-C-H, and it's... you know, the tagline is before print totally, you know, coughs up and dies, various magazines come into the city, magazine editors come in, and people come in on the topic of the magazine and try to pitch stories. And the magazines that preceded us were a couple months ago were High Times and then Van Goria and then UFO Magazine. And in typical fashion, just like tonight, we heard... all kinds of stories. Now, what was interesting about the pitch show was no matter what somebody came in terms of the audience or the actual guys pitching and ladies pitching stories, we've heard it all before. And I'm always reminded of, since I started working on this magazine, the ones I've fallen for that, in fact, turned out to be scams. And I'm always embarrassed by it, but, you know, hope springs eternal. And that is part of the whole burnout syndrome. Do you finally say, screw it, you know, we're too many people are scamming us, or does one news story grab you and make you want to start all over again? And we heard one of those stories at the pitch, and I hope we can find the, I hope we can investigate it well enough to find out stuff. And then the guy tonight, Viper, is one of those people. Makes you want to keep working. Makes you want to keep figuring this thing out. We were going to have a longer than usual show and have two experts on afterward, but I really feel strongly that we need to spend all the time we can with Viper. If you'll see why when he starts to talk, if he's the real thing, you simply want to keep on asking him questions. And for those in the chat, write your questions out, and I will try. Even though I get a bad reputation for interrupting, but I will in fact interrupt and try to get all the questions in. Okay, that was my piece.
Okay. Okay, that's fine. I'm excited about tonight because a lot of the material that Viper talked about in a conference call that we had earlier this week was stuff that, on the one hand, echoed a lot of what Bob Lazar said. He mentioned, I'm going to ask him about Bob Lazar, obviously, tonight. He talked about Bob Lazar, but more importantly, he talked about two things that I'd heard before, not necessarily at, and we're talking about Papoose Lake, not necessarily at Papoose Lake, but at once at Edwards Air Force Base, about a craft that was supposedly reverse engineered, or they were working on the propulsion system of an alien craft and got it to hover X number of feet off the floor using the anti-gravity drive. And this person is not a physicist, he's not a scientist, he's not a propulsion expert, so he's not a Bob Lazar, from the point of view that Bob Lazar was actually there to help reverse engineer the propulsion systems. This person is not a John Lear. He is simply a fly on the wall.
It's what you started to do last week. Don't say his profession, etc. I think unless he wants you to.
Right. No, I'm going to ask him that, but I'm just going to say right. He was not. Instead of what he was not. So right. So you're not going to get the technical expertise of a physicist. You're going to get something else.
Right, and of course, for my money, he has the ring of truth, which makes me feel, after you talked to him last week, I wandered around for a little bit feeling like, if you saw the movie Red, R-E-D, recently, Red stands for Retired Extremely Dangerous, and it was this fun movie with another Bruce Willis vehicle in which, Bruce Willis gets himself punched in the face and basically walks around with scars most of the movie. But in that movie, a bunch of people come and try to wipe out his little his house. Millions of rounds of ammunition are coming at his house from every angle. Of course, he escapes, etc. But that's what I kept thinking was going to happen to us after talking to Viper last week. I kept feeling that at any minute they're going to all burst in and take us out because we shouldn't have been listening to him. We shouldn't hear what he's saying. And that's, of course, who knows? That's the hallmark of the truth, is it? Or does that mean that if he's talking, he can't be telling the truth? Who knows? Well, on the other hand, I really do think that this is such a festering sore. Sorry, Jamie. But it's such a, because Jamie is our producer.
Hello.
And he had a bit of a festering thing going on in his mouth, but it's a wisdom tooth trying to break through. But I feel like the secret is that way. The government kind of like maybe lets some of it burst out here and there rather than the whole thing blow up. And so maybe the guy... And then I was thinking this morning, wouldn't it be interesting if the government is like a bureaucratic DMZ with no more power than that, basically, and all the real power lies in the big corporations, and Viper will talk about that, the corporations, and maybe, you know, the government that we're all afraid of or whatever, it doesn't even matter anymore. They just kind of, you know, write the checks, you know,
cash the checks,
stuff, yeah. And basically, you know, and the government maybe doesn't matter, and it's really the corporations which we will never, ever pierce. And Viper does mention corporations. The corporations are all involved here.
Right, and he mentions them by name, too.
Yes, he does. And they are not, there's no FOIA, Freedom of Information Act, involving corporations. You know, good luck with that. You're never going to get through that. So... I'm a perpetual chicken. I'm in the wrong profession probably, but, you know, I am curious, and we'll see.
So. Well, it's going to be an interesting, it's going to be an interesting conversation to be sure, and I'll tell you who I wrote to. I wrote to Tom Carey, who wrote the book with Don Schmidt, Witness to Roswell, and explained to Tom Carey that we're having issues with our conferences. I didn't want to get too involved in, like, tech stuff. But we will send Tom Carey the link to the show and ask him to comment. Tom Carey was an Air Force officer.
Right. And, well, and let me say this. He, when he wrote to you, he wrote to me originally and or to you through me, and he specifically mentioned Kevin Randall as a person who also seems to be very skeptical about this whole situation, Area 51, and he mentioned my name, and so we were going to ask Kevin to participate, and I have not, typical, I have not gotten around to it yet. I respect Kevin's time too much to simply set something up that may or may not happen, so I thought best thing to do is to ask Kevin to listen and perhaps comment. And by the way, next week we will not be on the air because Bill is going to be in transit. He's going to be coming back from a whole press junket for this new movie called
The Battle of L.A. by Columbia Pictures.
Yeah, Sony, I think.
Sony, yeah, well, Sony owns Columbia Pictures, and the folks
so
involved.
You, yeah, they're asking you and this, and who else is going to be
well,
doing?
Well, the four people involved that I know about, it's Colonel Halt, Charles Halt from the very famous RAF Bentwaters case, and Captain Robert Salas. So Colonel Charles Halt, Air Force. Captain Robert Salas, Air Force. Robert Salas wrote the book about the Maelstrom Air Force Base shutdown, the missile silo shutdown. And both Colonel Halt and Captain Salas were members of Bob Hastings' panel at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. about UFOs interfering with military activities, particularly UFOs over nuke sites. Bentwaters was a nuke site. Maelstrom was a nuke site. And the other person is a MUFON member who was in the MUFON organization, Mark Easter, who was also a part of the Discovery Channel's
your task in California next week is going to be to get all three of those fellows to come on the show at different times. That's a given, okay?
Right. I mean, I'm really excited about, we of course saw Charles Halt when in season one on UFO Hunters when we did the Bentwaters story, and then on working with Paul and Ben Eno and all the witnesses from RAF Bentwaters, we had a series of radio shows on Bentwaters, culminating, I think, in this commemorative a visit to Rendlesham Forest at the end of December, December 28th or 29th last year. So we can talk about that. And but it's exciting because it's good to see Colonel Halt again.
I don't understand how this is for a movie called Battle of L.A. And I don't understand why they have you and all and the other panelists giving conferences and talks for 4 or 5 days. It seems, you know, how can they possibly, you know, fill that much time with this antique story? I'll be interested. You'll be, you know, I'll be learning more as you tell me things that are happening. But it seems like an awful lot of money spent, an awful, you know, for something that happened a long time ago. Remember, there was also that failed movie that Spielberg did, right?
Right. Well, that was 1941, and that wasn't about UFOs. That was simply about the fact that in 1942, at the very end of 1941, early 42, a Japanese submarine surfaced off Santa Barbara.
Oh, so it wasn't this particular battle of...
No. A Japanese submarine surfaced off Santa Barbara, fired weapons at Santa Barbara, submerged, and headed south.
It had nothing to do with aliens?
Nothing to do with aliens. It was a story about a Japanese submarine attack off the California coast.
Do you know ahead of time whether this movie is fictional?
This is a fiction movie. This is a movie about it. It takes place today. It's basically about an alien invasion, and it is starring Adam Eckhart from Thank You for Smoking.
Ah, it's not. It's not about the historical battle.
No, the reason that the four of us are on the panel is to talk about real historical UFO-related incidents. That's
well,
the whole purpose of the
panel.
That's
weird. If it's fictional, why don't they just have a press junket with movie stars instead of real people and real UFO stuff?
Well, Warren Betts, who was running the publicity, this was over a year and a half ago, when he contacted me, he said one of his ideas for this was to couch the fictional story in the context of the original myth. It wasn't even a myth, the lore, because we still don't know to this day what the object was. But this actual event that took place in 1942 over Santa Monica Bay, over Redondo Beach, real witnesses, Scott Littleton, very famous guy, was a witness. But to couch this in that matrix, this happened then in 1942. Folks could go to the trailer for the movie. They can go to the publicity for the movie.
Okay, and also in chat, they're mentioning that Jose Escamilla has a movie coming out about the real battle. So that's something else that we probably, you know, I have to, I will check out. Jose has done, he did a movie a while ago. He was known originally for The Rods, R-O-D-S. He got in a lot of trouble for that. But he did a movie a few years ago that I saw at a conference. A similar movie to the movie in concept was like the press conferences that we're talking about.
Right,
which
right.
I think he showed some of the press conferences. But the thing about the movie, it had a patriotic feel to it. And at the conference, I think it was at one of the New Age.
It was the Conscious Life Expo in February.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's what it was. But I'm telling you, people stood up and were just cheering at the end of it. It made you feel, you know, very proud to be an American, proud to be in this situation that we all find ourselves in, where we have enough courage, I want to say, to keep on trying to investigate this. I say that at the end of the show tonight, I'm going to be under the covers with, you know, my safety blanket that will keep lasers from getting me. But anyway, Jose's movie was really good, and some people in the UFO field really do excoriate him because of the rods to this day. But I think I've met him, and he seems like a very sincere, very decent, very honorable person. So here, there's a link to the movie. If you're on chat, there's Big Feet just put up a link. If you're in chat, and if you're not in chat, go to chat. If you're listening to the show after it's live, don't go to chat. That would be silly. But actually, the chat is always alive at some point because Jamie's network. And it's not okay. The network is called Inception Radio Network, and there's always something happening. And the chat is almost always there's always somebody there. And in fact, I think if you felt like you wanted to reach out and touch another UFO enthusiast, I think you could just open up Inception Radio Network, go to the chat link, which is at the top, and you could talk to people. But meanwhile, during the actual shows on the network, the chat's alive and well. And I will now name the shows because I wrote them down this week. And they are, listen to the shows that are lined up here. Jerry Pippin, Pang Radio, Paranexus, PSN Radio, Soup Media Network, The Alien Tarmac, and that's Bob Tarmac. He made the fabulous music at the beginning. Angela Joyner's show, The Joyner Report.
The Joyner Report.
UFO Traffic Report, West Georgia Paranormal, and Tom Donahue's Free Thinker. And all of them are the kinds of shows that, you know, once you start listening, you know, you're kind of addicted in a really good way. And so you can chat while you go. And of course, you know, sometimes the actual folks who do these shows are on chat while you're listening to the show live, which adds a lot. You can jangle them, like, you know, I'm easily jangled. And or you can ask questions during the show. And tonight, for example, we will, you know, I watch the chat as I go because I'm, you know,
right. This particular guest is going to be laying down a lot of facts and a lot of assertions and claims. So, folks in the chat, and if you're not in the chat, join the chat because you really are going to be able to get your two cents in, asking certain kinds of questions and make them as specific as you want to. And Nancy will read the chat questions and see if Viper can answer them.
Right, and you know, as I said, we actually know this fellow's real name, and we decided, you know, obviously he doesn't want to give his real name, but we'll see how it goes. We'll see how it goes.
Now it's funny. Viper is one of two people who contacted us over the past couple of weeks. The other person, actually three people with significant stuff. One person contacted us talking about a strange satellite canopy that we have, which is top secret. Another person, in light of the Battle of L.A. and what happened in 1942 over Santa Monica, said that his father owned an auto parts store in Inglewood. Anybody who knows Southern California knows that Inglewood, Santa Monica, Redondo Beach are all in the same basic area. And his father owned an auto parts store in Inglewood. And an LAPD officer who was called to alert, because the LAPD was put on alert, obviously, in 1942 as the artillery shells started firing. They were scouring the beach on Redondo Beach where this took place. And they found pieces of something they couldn't identify. And since there was a war on and car parts in the 1940s, there was rationing in the United States in the 1940s. Ration books, rationing milk, nylons, rubber, you can imagine.
I have a ration book in my baby book.
There you go, a ration book.
So, because she had to ration my formula.
Well, that was one of the many things that was rationed, exactly. You couldn't buy nylon in the United States during the war because it was used for military purposes. So the... this person needed, this LAPD person needed spark plugs. Again, ration, because they were all going to military vehicles. So he traded a piece of what he found on the beach the morning after it to this car parts store owner. And apparently this person has it and will send it to me. And I will tell the story of this at the Battle of LA press conference next Wednesday.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Well, it is cool.
Are you gonna see it? Is he gonna physically hand it off?
Ideally, if he overnighted it, I'll get it. I'm not gonna get it before we leave. Because,
well, you know what? If it comes,
it's a holiday.
What if it comes when you're not here?
Well, it's gonna come to the post office box when I'm not here.
Well, and it will sit at the post office. Well, if it comes in the UPS,
It will not come in UPS. It's coming in USPS to the post office box. I thought it would come today, but it didn't. So it was not in Lambertville. So what I am going to do is basically, I'll tell the story. I'll say I'm expecting.
Well, I'll get a ride and try to find it for you.
Well, you have to go to Lambertville because that's where it's going.
Yeah, as I said, I'll get a ride and maybe do that. Also. when Bill is gone, what's going to be coming here, and I know we have to kind of close up this little chat soon, bring our guest on, but when Bill is gone, what will be coming will be his house for his owls, which is our attempt to control the mice population, because Bill's now decided that he's going to ask owls to come and live on our property.
Well, this place is, this whole glen, bowl, you know, hollow, whatever you want to call it, along Primrose Creek, is actually an owl haven. We were coming back from New York City on Monday night, late. I mean, late. It was early Tuesday morning.
No, it was early Wednesday morning.
Wednesday morning. The hooting from these owls was incredible. And they weren't barn owls. They were barred.
And not only that, when we were coming back very late. Nobody else was on the road. A deer ran out and actually just hit the side of our car and kept on going. It was quite the night. Yeah.
It was. So there are barn owls that live in this little hollow because you could hear them screeching. They're called screech owls.
Wait a second. Someone is saying in chat, by the way, the barn owls like to peck at people's eyes. So you might want to keep that in mind. Because Bill's afraid he's going to fall asleep outside and a barn owl is going to come and peck his eyes. So that's actually a fear of Bill's.
Well, they do peck at people's eyes if you're too close to the their nest.
But I don't believe that at all, and I am naive. But that's, you know, I think
great horned owls. Great horned owls do peck at people.
Well, then you want to wear sunglasses then when you're outside at all times. You see, or goggles. In fact, I'll get you owl goggles.
Well,
save you.
Barn owls are phenomenally cautious, except if you're a mouse.
Yeah. Yeah, and speaking of bats, which we are speaking of here, bats are, you know, if we have as many stink bugs as I think we're going to be having, supposedly bats are... So here we are, we're going to buy a bat house and an owl house. This place is going to be overrun with weed.
And bats are one of the favorite foods of barn owls.
Ah.
You know, they're flying rodents.
Messing with the balance of nature so much as we're doing.
There
so
we are. Sick. We're gonna have a little ecosystem along Primrose Creek. Too bad there are no fish in the creek. Then you'd really have fun.
Well, there used to be. Yeah.
There used to be. The fish would eat the mosquitoes.
No.
Here we go.
Okay, Jamie, I think it might be time for us to do what we got to do.
All right.
Okay.
So we're going to be calling.
I'm scared. I'm going to be very quiet for the.
Okay. Well, you listen and then home in with questions. But we are going to be calling codename Viper, and this is going to be very exciting.
Ow! Did you fall?
Yes.
Tell me when to hit go.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Hello,
Viper.
Yep.
Hi, Viper. Bill. This is Bill and Nancy, and welcome to Future Theater Radio, and thank you for joining us.
Hi, Nancy.
Hi, Viper.
Thank you for inviting me.
You certainly kind of rocked our week with the story that we talked about when we were on the phone earlier this week, and I want to thank you for sharing it, and what I'd like to do, if we can start this way, why don't you begin, because I'm going to let you do a lot of the talking, obviously. Why don't we begin by your telling us what prompted you to contact us in the first place and what the basis was of the conversation, of what you talked about?
Well, the biggest reason that I wanted to call you was, I don't know, I guess I'm tired of the hype and the falsehood, you know, like you see, for example, everybody goes to Roswell, and you see these crazy people wearing these masks, and, you know, alien features and stuff, and it's, you know, it's kind of ridiculous, and then people are taken away from the truth of what's actually happening. Those people make a mockery of it. You know, it's kind of like Hollywood. you know, they make a mockery of what is actually happening, and the people, you know, you got 80% of the country believes in UFOs, but, you know, they don't know what to believe because, you know, if you say you do believe in UFOs, you're laughed at. Now, me personally, I don't care if you believe in them or if you don't. The only thing I can tell you is what I've seen, and either you can believe me or you don't believe me.
Now, can we start with basically, you know, without revealing anything more than you want to reveal, obviously, just what your background was in the military service and where you worked, which is the subject of really what you're talking about.
Well, I joined the Air Force to be an air traffic controller, but due to my mechanical background, I ended up in the heating and air conditioning field, and then I ended up at Nellis Air Force Base. And of course, you know, when most people think of heating and air conditioning, you know, you go think of turning your thermostat and your air conditioner comes on. Well, that might be true for a house because it's run electronically, but in big commercial buildings, it's run on air pressure, and each thermostat's got to be adjusted. So you got to go from office to office to adjust them, and you got to go up in the air handlers and adjust the pneumatic valves that are opening and closing the dampers, because sometimes they get out of alignment and stuff. And then one day I got a letter to report to the squadron headquarters, and he says, here, you're going over to base ops. You're going to be the squadron MBC NCOIC. And I said, okay, what's that? You know.
Yeah, I was going to say, what's that?
Yeah, I had no idea. So I went and showed up at this class, and come to find out it was nuclear, biological, and chemical warfare type class. And what they did was they taught you how to get in this MBC suit. It was like an MA1 suit, and how to use the respirator. Of course, I had glasses, so I was delayed until the lab could make me a pair of glasses that fit inside my respirator. And then the next thing I know, I'm shipped off to a place called Groom Lake Airfield, which at that time was called the Sea Annex. And then from there I was shipped to which was called the D Annex, which was Papoose Lake. And there, I don't know if you've ever been to either one. Oops. Is that you calling, Bill?
No.
Okay.
Okay.
I'll tell you.
We can let that go.
Well, I think that's on Viper's line.
Yep.
Okay.
Well, can you tell us how old you were, Viper, when you first put the suit on, for example? What?
I was 18.
Wow.
Well, and I joined the Air Force when I was 17.
And how old are you now?
I'm over 50.
Okay.
Okay. So you wind up at Papoose Lake.
Right. Which
and
is...
What?
Papoose Lake is nothing but an apron, or like a big parking lot. It's got a road coming to a parking lot. And then you go like into the side of a mountain. Like if you've ever watched, what was that show? War Games or whatever, on how they go into...
What, Thunder Mountain?
No. Yeah, where NORAD is, up
yeah.
there in Colorado.
Right.
Only... there's no gate entry, or you don't see a doorway. It's all camouflaged. And then once you get inside there, at the time I was working there, there was 9 hangars and 20 offices and 2 laboratories. And now from what I heard, there's 12 hangars and 40 some offices and like 4 labs in there now.
Well, Viper, why are there hangars inside the mountain?
because of aircraft that the NBC people like me that recovered, you know, Air Force, Army together recovered, we would recover these objects that weren't aircraft that were built in the U.S. or anywhere else on this earth, as far as I'm concerned, but they weren't built in the U.S. They were not U.S. aircraft. And they'd take them into these hangars.
Well, are these aircraft intact, or are they in pieces?
Well, there was five that were intact and four that were in pieces.
And in tiny pieces, or mostly?
Well, it'd go anywhere from, I mean, when you go out on a site, I mean, you would pick up what you could pick up visually, and guys would walk around with, like, a metal detector and pick up what else they could pick up. It just depended on the site. None of the eight sites I was on were the same. I mean,
okay, and when you say intact, the four intact ones, were they the
five intact?
Were they the size of human vehicles, or were they smaller? In other words, did they look like they would hold human occupants, or did they seem too small for that, the four intact objects?
If you were a dwarf, if you're under 4 foot tall,
okay,
definitely have to be under 5 foot tall.
And in every case, they were that size. No, none of them were huge mothership things.
Well, the biggest one we recovered was right at 40 foot. Most were between 12 and 32 foot.
And what is the surface material? Is the surface material the same in every case?
No.
Mm-hmm.
And the metals weren't the same in every case, I should say.
And would you, and to your eyes, did you ever touch any of these physically, the intact ones that hangar?
All eight of them.
Did they feel like regular metal in every case?
No.
Okay.
How would you describe what they felt like?
Like a polished stainless steel or polished aluminum, only when you look at the thickness of them, it was like picking up aluminum foil or like saran wrap. I mean, it was just, it's so hard to explain because, you know, you see this piece, this hunk of metal out there, and you know it's going to take 10 guys to pick up this chunk of metal. And one guy goes, picks it up, puts it on his shoulder, and hauls it over to the truck. You know, it's like, you're just flabbergasted.
Well, do you feel that all of these objects that you've handled all come from the same type of species, or do they all feel like they're the same kind of things? You know what I mean?
If you
handled only airplane crashes, you would say to yourself, they're kind of all airplanes, even though they're from other countries. Would you say that all of these items, these objects, the intact ones and the pieces, would you say they are all from the same kind of creators?
Yeah.
Okay.
So when you were out, where did you retrieve some of these aircraft from? Let's start with that. So you were on an NBC team. It was a retrieval team. You were wearing various kinds of hazmat suits, protective gear. Where did you go, Viper, to retrieve some of these craft?
There was three in Texas. There was two in Mexico.
In New Mexico or the country
New
Mexico?
New Mexico.
New Mexico.
Right out. One was right in White Sands missile range, and another one was north of the missile range, right at the edge of a mountain range. I can't remember right now, but it's got an Indian name to it, Anasazi, I think. Is there an Anasazi mountain range there?
No, it's the Sangre de Cristo.
Don't sound familiar. But I know it was on, that particular one was on an Indian reservation itself.
Was it the Jicarilla Apache?
No, it's the one that the word that means star. But now we're in Texas. Also, let's just move right to the Texas ones.
One was between San Angelo and Odessa, Texas.
And what year was that?
All three of the Texas ones were in 78.
1978.
January 1. The first one I went on, I have no idea because they didn't tell us. I mean, we were like in blackout. And that's the one where I picked up like the huge pieces and it left, you know, like I told you, that huge crater that was 20 foot deep and 40 to 60 foot across, and they dug down 38 feet to get the pod things out. Now that one, I would take a guess. It was in this. If I was to, I would say Central Texas hill land country.
Oh wait, no, Central Texas, and what kind of country?
In the hill country.
Okay. In the hill country.
But in a flat land, but you'd be in the hill country, like between Austin and San Antonio towards, I'd say east of I-35.
Okay.
And then the other one would have been out by El Paso by Fort Bliss, just off Fort Bliss.
Now, were you?
I mean,
Were these sites already covered by civilians, or were you the first ones there? In other words, were these picked over sites when you got there?
No. Like the very first one I went on, there was two Texas Highway Patrolmen sitting at the front gate. And as we drove in, I mean, it was all Air Force personnel in there. At the first one I went on, there was no Army personnel at all, period. Now, the second and third one I was on, Army was the first ones there.
Okay.
And at no time did I ever see any civilians on any of the... Any of the recovery sites.
You're saying that even though the material was very light, I want to go right back to what you said about the pods. It dug into the ground. The crash in Texas went right into the ground.
Well, if you take the core of it, you'd call your engine compartment or whatever. It hit the ground so hard it buried itself 38 feet deep.
Wow. Was it still smoking when you got to it?
It wasn't smoking until, like, the backhoe things that dug it out and the crane latched onto the pieces and pulled it up. Yeah, the pieces were still hot. And some of the pieces that we picked up, yeah, you could feel the heat through your gloves.
Okay.
How hot, I couldn't tell you.
And before we leave this particular one, when you say pod things, what did you mean right there?
Well, the what you would consider like an engine, like an airplane engine, you know, piston engine or jet engine or a regular car engine.
Mm-hmm.
These craft got like cylindrical pods. They almost look like a ceramic conductor or something. They're three or four foot high, about 18 inches in diameter. And that's, all the ones I remember seeing had four of them. And they all had four, like, little engine pods.
Wow. And those pods were all, you guys took those pods, were they radioactive? Do you know?
Some were, but they weren't what you would call above normal levels. I mean, you've got normal radioactivity, and then you got radioactivity that's above normal, and then radioactivity that's harmful. And mm-hmm. at none of the sites was it harmful, but it was, like the SR-71s that used to fly over Russia when they would set off a nuclear weapon. You know, our SR-71s would fly through it, and then they'd come into Groom Lake and land, and you'd have to run out in these MBC suits and wash them down with this special soap and stuff. And then the soap all went into a tank, special tank. You had to save everything. You clean the plane up and make, you know, de-radioactive it.
Right.
The word you'd use.
Well, were any parts of these crashes handled differently? For example, did the pods go to one kind of group, and then the metal fragments go to another?
No, everything went to Papoose Lake. The only thing I remember going to a different place was outside of St. George in the Virgin Mountains when we had a red flag mission. There was one that an F-4 was coming up one side of the mountain and this UFO was on the other, and the F-4 hit it in the back and it like crashed into the other side of the mountain. And then when we got there, the time I got there, I should say, my squadron got there, they already had, there was two body bags that were laying there.
Mm-hmm. For humans or for not humans?
Well, I don't know what was in the body bags. That's all I can tell you is they were very small body bags, like a child's body bag.
And what does red flag mission mean?
It's Air Force has like these war games. You know, they invite all different squadrons, either from the U.S. or from all over the world, and you go out over the Nevada test range or the bomb range, and you sit there and play these war games, and you have like cap missions, you know, like the F-15s, they fly the cap missions. You got the F-16s, they fly the combat missions, and then you got like the A-10 War Dogs. They used to like fly down through the canyons and stuff, and they used to play like the tanks and against like the Army and stuff. And that's like, if you ever hear of an A-10 crashing at Nellis, usually he's crashed because he's running through the Virgin Mountains at 300 knots and, you know, he can't pull out or something.
So
because if you're a war dog pilot.
So in Operation Red Flag, one side takes the enemy, one side takes the aggressors and defenders, right?
Right. Like, if you're up at Groom Lake, they've got what they call red hats. I mean, we've got, like, MiG-21s, 25s, 27s out there. You got them, what are they, S-22s. They've got all these Russian craft. Back when I was, you know, back in the 60s and 70s, they used to have like this, you'd get $1 million in gold or $1 million U.S. if you, you know, defect with your plane from China or Russia or North Korea or wherever. If you were flying a Russian plane, there was $1 million reward out, and they'd bring that plane to Nellis Air Force Base, and it'd literally strip it down and then put it back together. You know, it's like one thing about a Russian plane versus an American plane is when I was there, they couldn't believe that, you know, they were still all handmade. They were, and how much heavier they were than the American aircraft, but how much better their engines were than our engines.
Mm-hmm. So an F-4, so in one of the red flag operations, an F-4 Phantom jet hit a UFO.
Hit the back of it. Well, it,
when you say hit, it hit with a missile or it hit as a, it was an impact?
Okay, if you can imagine a mountain peak, you know, just be looking at a mountain peak. An F-4 coming up one side of the mountain peak, a UFO coming up over the other side. And as the F-4 tops the mountain peak, there's a UFO. And he hits it, and the UFO, like, turns down and heads down into the valley and hits the mountain on the other side.
Well, did the F-4 crash as well in this instance?
Yeah, it crashed, killed a pilot.
And what was the pilot's family told?
That he died in a training mission.
Mm-hmm. And Do the UFOs ever, do they ordinarily mix in with our war games?
I wouldn't know, but that was the first time that I've ever, that we ever experienced it at Nellis.
Okay, so your team was dispatched to retrieve that crashed UFO, and what happened? Tell us exactly what happened.
We were dispatched to retrieve the F-4.
I see.
And when we ended up at the UFO crash. There was nothing left of the F-4. So, somewhere en route we got diverted to this, because that particular UFO, with the exception of a big dent in it where it hit the mountain, was, I'd say, I don't know, 75%, 80% intact, 90% intact.
And as you know, Viper, we have a chat room in which folks are giving questions. And, of course, the question right now is, what do these things look like? So let's start with this one with the dent in it. What did it look like from, what shape is it?
That one was, I don't know how you'd explain your typical UFO saucer shape, but this one had more of the, it looked like that Scion, that new Scion car. The dome part was kind of boxy. It was kind of, it wasn't a round dome. It was more like a box dome type, but it was round. And the bottom just looked like a coffee plate saucer with like four white spots in the bottom where the pods were.
Okay. And the pods were the propulsion? They were the engines?
Yeah. And when I was a Papoose Lake, I was always, what the engineers would always say is that they were some type of anti-gravitational engine, and each one of those pods could create an enormous amount of energy.
Did they ever figure out what drove the pods, what the propulsion was?
When I was there, no. They were still trying to figure out how to make them work. I've since talked to a guy that, when I was there, they had them working to where they'd get them off the ground just hovering 4 feet. And he says, no, they go up like, now they just run the engines, he said. He said, you remember the barrels? I go, yeah. He says, well, they run them up like 175 feet, 100 feet up in the air now. I said, nah. So they figured out what they were then. But me personally, no. I've long been from Papoose Lake, so I can only go with my friends, are still at Nellis and are in the service or in the civilian part of it. We'll talk about.
So a Phantom jet runs into the rear of a circular craft with a kind of a boxy-shaped dome on it and four anti-gravity pods.
Yeah, no, wait a second. The Phantom jet is destroyed and the domed UFO is just dented, correct?
Right. You could see the green and brown paint from the F-4 where it hit on the back side of it. That was sticking out from the mountain, because the crane had come out. They actually took a backhoe and scraped the rock away, and then the crane picked it up and put it on a big flatbed truck, and they drove it out to where this big sky crane picked it up.
And the two body bags were from the UFO.
Right. That's what I was told.
Yeah. So you were told that, and they were about, you said a child size. Would you say 4 feet, 5 feet?
Yeah. It wasn't a normal, I've been to many aircraft sites, a normal body bag takes four guys to pick it up, and this one, just two guys, picked it up. We loaded it on a deuce and a half, and we drove it to a C-130, and we got on the C-130, and then we flew to New York State, and then they ended up at some place called Brookhaven
National Laboratories on Long Island?
Yeah, there you go.
Now you rode with, you're saying you rode with the body bags in the C-130.
Right.
And so you're a living witness to a retrieval of something that crashed, body right. bags were retrieved, and you rode with those body bags, and to your knowledge, they went to Brookhaven National Laboratories.
Right, but I cannot tell you what was in them body bags.
Well, could were you,
parts,
were you,
for all I know. I don't
how,
know.
How far from the body bags were you when you were in the transport with them?
Well, I was sitting in a jump seat, and they were sitting in a stainless steel box in the center of the C-130 on a pallet, so... I don't know, 5 feet, I suppose.
I mean, the whole flight, were you afraid that sort of like you'd start to hear them knocking, or were you afraid like in the movie The Thing or something? Did that go through your mind?
No.
No?
I mean, I never seen The Thing, so I wouldn't. I mean, when you're in the Air Force and you're an airman or a sergeant, you know, this colonel comes up and screaming and yelling at you, you know, you're like scared to death. You do what you're told. You keep your mouth shut, and you just, I don't know. I mean, when that happened, you know, I don't think Alien had come out yet.
What year was this?
Yeah.
This would have been 79.
Okay.
Okay, now, before we leave the crash site, I just wanted to ask, were there any smells that you remember at the crash sites, or the various crash sites?
Smells.
That were, you know, smells that
sulfur
might...
Sulfur or burnt metal, sulfur. Things like that.
Yeah, if you've ever been in a foundry after they freshly poured, like, iron or steel or aluminum, yeah, you get... That was the burnt with part of it, I guess. But well, they weren't like normal aircraft sites, because you go to a normal aircraft site, I mean, you can smell the burning bodies, you know, that like knocks you out first, and then, you know, you can smell the burnt aluminum, and you can smell the burnt copper wiring from the insulation on the wiring and stuff, and, you know, you can smell the burnt foam from seats. None of those smells you smell, you know, the only thing it was like a heat smell, you know, it was like from, like, out of Kilauea, I guess, you know, when you smell the hot lava without the sulfur smell. But when I can't say there was a sulfur smell, no.
Okay. When you've, were there any smells, the kinds of smells that right before a thunderstorm or like a thunderclap and then you smell the ozone, was there a smell like that?
Yeah, I could say that, Bill, but you gotta remember, I mean, that would be an hour after I'd been at the site, because the first hour I was there, I was in an NBC suit. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, after everything was cleared and okayed and everything, and then you were allowed to take your respirator off and stuff, then I'd have to say the two in New Mexico, yeah, they really, now that I think about it, that ozone smell, yeah, I'd have to say the two in New Mexico really had that strong smell. But the others, I'd have to say no.
And so what was the year that you stopped going to the crashes?
83, 84.
Okay, so we're talking about the late 70s up to 83, 84.
Yeah, because I got out in April of 84.
Well, can you speculate that things like this are still going on?
Yeah, I know they are.
Well, how do you know that?
Well, okay, I got a buddy that works in base ops still. He's a civilian now at Nellis.
Yeah.
We were at the docks in Laughlin, Nevada, down at the state park. And I don't know, when was it? May 8th, 2008? I can't remember. And this thing comes whistling over the top of our head. I thought it was a meteor. So, that afternoon, I called my buddy up at Nellis, and I said, hey, you realize down here in Laughlin, we seen a meteor fly over our head. And he says, nah, that wasn't a meteor. I said, hell, it wasn't. I said, I was with my son-in-law. You want me to put him on the phone? Mm-hmm. He says, no, that was one of our military satellites that overshot like 250 miles. I said, what are you talking about? He says, well, the parachutes didn't deploy, and it was supposed to land in Nellis Test Range. It was a military satellite, and they didn't want anybody know anything about it. And I don't know, I guess it's one of them spy satellites I got up there that Bell or Hughes makes. And I thought that was kind of interesting.
Well, now, is that the object that landed in Needles, California?
Yeah, it crashed in Needles, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Now, do you think that some of the things you retrieved were our military?
The eight other items that we
retrieved? Yes.
No way, no way.
And why do you say
that? We didn't make them, Russians didn't. Okay, every plane we make has got wiring in it. It's got cabling in it. It's got hydraulic lines in it. These didn't have none of that. When you've seen one open or in pieces, at no time do you see a hydraulic line. You see electrical line, electrical cable, a steel cable, to move the ailerons or, actuator arms or anything like that.
Well,
what do you see?
Well, wait, let me ask one more question. Are there any windows in these crafts? What we would call windows?
What you would call windows? No, because I'll take number 4, for example, that I remember well, because that one was open. And when its doors was open, it had like 2 levels. You could see like what I would call an engine room, and you could see up on the upper deck. Now, of course, you got to remember, that time I was like 6'6", 6'7". And I could look straight in. And when you look at the dome from the outside, it's solid silver. It looks like polished stainless steel. Mm-hmm. But when you look inside it, you could look at the walls all the way around the hangar.
Uh-huh.
So you could actually look out it, but it looked like stainless steel.
Right, like a two-way mirror.
Yeah, there you go, two-way mirror. But... Yeah.
And did you
as
say
far as windows? No, none of the ones I ever recovered had
so
windows.
Yeah, and you say you're 6'7"?
Almost was.
And so you're too big to get into these things.
Oh yeah, I get my head in it. we had a bunch of small guys that were like 5'1" in our squadron that would crawl all over inside them, and you'd ask them, hey man, what'd you see in there? What'd you see? And they'd tell you everything.
What did they tell you they saw?
Yeah,
what did they see? Well, like, for example, there was no seats.
Mm-hmm.
There was no bathrooms.
Mm-hmm.
Or, what we call a bathroom. No place to eat.
Mm-hmm.
There was like no food in there, no bathroom, no water. Like you'd find on a normal plane.
Right, but so what was in the space? What did the space contain?
It was just space. There was nothing there. It was just like what I could see, it was just like, from where I was standing, I could see like 270-degree nothing but control panel type. What I would call a control panel.
And what do you mean by what did it look like, control panel?
Well, it was on a slant, maybe 22-degree angle, maybe 18 inches in width, and kind of like encompassed the area of the ship, and it looked like petroglyphs, I guess you'd say, or Egyptian hieroglyphs. There was like nothing you would say would be like letters or sentences or something. It was just more pictures and weird stuff.
Were they carved in, or were they something you could run your hands over?
Yeah, it was like like a flat screen monitor, but at an angle.
Okay, what about lights?
What about lights?
Well, lights. I mean, was the inside lit in any way?
Number four was, yeah. Number four was an operational.
Okay.
Operational breath. I mean, they actually took it out on the apron and got it to go up, you know, sit there and hover like 4 feet.
Well, how was number four captured?
That's the one we would have picked up in White Sands, New Mexico.
Okay, and
how did that crash, number four?
I think it crashed in a lightning storm, because right before that's when we picked up, or right after that we picked up number five, because number five had a hole in it. Mm-hmm. And now that one was in, we stuck in bay nine. We stood it up on the end, so when, if you looked at it, it looked like a missile went through it. But the witness report said, or pilot report said, that it got hit by lightning.
Well, do you think that lightning brings most of them down?
With the exception of the one that got hit by the F-4? Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And you don't
I think that's the only thing that can bring them down.
You don't think HARP has anything to do with it?
Oh, I think HARP could bring them down, yeah.
But you don't know for a fact that HARP has brought them down. You just know that perhaps lightning.
Mm.
Did it? I mean, when people talked about this, and I want to ask you a little bit about who the people were at Papoose Lake. Did you get a chance to talk to any of the officers, scientists, et cetera, et cetera? When they talked about it, in describing these things, did they characterize these things as like millions of years ahead of us, or technology we could vaguely understand if we had a little more background information? How did they characterize these to you?
Beyond our conception.
Well, do you agree with that from what you've seen?
No.
You don't?
No.
How come?
Just because it seems like all of a sudden, you know, instead of big old fat electrical switches that are made out of carbide, are now tiny diodes made out of silicon.
Right, and they also come down, I might add. So they're coming. This is an opinion question. Do you think with all the ones that have come down, do you think that there would therefore be tons more that are not coming down? So therefore there's a lot in our skies?
A lot. What would you consider a lot?
More than one. You know, I mean, and, you know.
Well, in my 7 years, I've seen eight, but they come down in clusters. Now, like when they energized HARP out there in White Sands, mm-hmm. you know, it was way back when. It was within a day or two that we found the one, and then right after that, we found another one with a hole in it. And like the ones in Texas, we got one in January, February, and April, I think. So that was like three right in a row. And then the two in White Sands. And then it was another year later. I think it was, when was it? January, February of 79. We had the one that crashed in Virgin Mountains. And then we had one that crashed in Arizona. That was later in the year. That one was up by Flagstaff, if I remember right. Somewhere between Flagstaff and Winslow, Arizona. And then we had the other one that crashed in Nevada.
Well, you're telling us all this. Do you feel that the government's ready for this to come out? Do you feel that you're in danger by talking about this?
Am I in danger?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, if they knew who I was, yeah, I'd probably lose all my VA benefits and my pension and stuff. Or they'd find a way to take it away from me or something. Yeah. And what's, I don't think the government wants it. No, no.
Yeah. Okay.
Because, okay, because if the government comes out and says two reasons. Number one, they can't protect our skies, and there's nothing that they can do about them, period. Number two, it blows every concept of religion off the face of the earth if you stop and think about it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you've got these things coming out of the sky, and then where is everybody's religion goes to? You know, next thing you know, okay, we don't have the Ten Commandments. We don't have the seven deadly sins. Next thing you know, you got mass chaos because, you know, a lot of people won't commit a crime because, hey, it's a sin. You know, it's like me. I'm not going to go to the grocery store and steal a banana because to me it's a sin. I was brought up, it was a sin. You know, and I would feel guilty about it. Now, if you didn't have the Ten Commandments, you wouldn't feel guilty about stealing something or killing somebody or whatever. And I think that's what the government's afraid of.
Well, did you have counseling? Did the crews you were part of have counseling after you'd retrieved these crashes?
Everyone debriefed. I learned after the first one, you kept your mouth shut.
Okay.
Because the first one...
What if you were having emotional problems? Would they take you off of it to try to help you?
Yeah, you get a Section 8 after you were court-martialed and given an Article 15. But I don't remember that happening that often. Most of the people, I mean, besides the psyche valves that you did, you know, you were too scared of your superiors. You were more scared of, you know, the tech sergeant or master sergeant above you, or the colonel or lieutenant colonel or captain above you, than what you found, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, because you could explain, oh, okay, I found a Chinese aircraft or I found a Russian aircraft. You could explain it off that way. Even though you knew it wasn't, you could explain it off that way.
Did any of these crashes reach the news, to your knowledge, as, you know, were there any flaps around them or cover stories or anything like that?
The only cover stories I remember was the one that the Red Flag Mission just said that the pilot crashed into the ground.
Okay.
But that was, you know, that was like a total falsehood. I mean, it hit another ship in the air. I mean, it was an air-to-air incident. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't what they said it was. If you want to call that a cover-up, yeah, that was a cover-up.
I want to ask you about on the one craft that crashed in New Mexico, you said you were able to see, I mean, it was in pieces, and you said you could, that there were no pneumatic lines, hydraulic lines, wires, cables, metal struts, things like that. What was there in its place? What did you see?
Well, that
place?
One wasn't in pieces, Bill. That, you're confusing me here.
Okay.
Okay. There was one in New Mexico that had the hole straight through it.
Right.
And then there's another one that could have come down in a lightning storm, or HAARP could have brought it down. Either one. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, but like the one with a hole through it, you know, like you take a missile and run it through the middle of a plane, you're going to see the insides of the plane. You're going to see the cables, the wires, the seats, everything else. You didn't see that in this one. And the other ones, when we picked up pieces, like I've been on wreck sites where you go pick up, you know, the cockpit. It's just, you know, nothing but thousands and thousands and thousands of wires and stuff, you know, and cables and everything else. And it's like even the tail section's full of cables and hoses, or the wings are full of hoses and cables and stuff. And nowhere on any of the pieces that you picked up was there anything like a wire or a cable or a hose or nothing. And that's what made them so unusual. That's why I don't believe they were built or made in Germany or Russia or China or Japan or anywhere else.
What was, how do you think they were connected? I mean, in terms of getting controlled from one part to the other. You know what I'm saying? Like, if there's no cables, wires, what do you think, from what you could see with your background in mechanics, how do you think they were propelled? Not propelled, but in place of the spaghetti that connects parts of airplanes.
Like a fiber optic. Type of fiber optic cable, but only flat.
Were there any liquids? Was anything sticky ever that you can remember?
Nope. No liquids, no gas, no water, no fluids draining out like hydraulic fluid.
And also, just another quick question. Has there ever been any reconnaissance from the people who make these for their fallen comrades? I mean, have they ever come back to look for who took their bodies or who took their pieces that you know of?
You'd ask to have, I'd ask the Air Force. That'd be a very good question to ask the Air Force.
You know.
Can you tell me how was Papoose Lake organized? I mean, take us inside Papoose Lake, inside that mountain, and tell us what went on and who was the boss and where were you and what were the levels of command and things like that.
Well, you had a civilian section and you had a military section. Okay, the military did you had like a military command, and then you had us flunkies that maintained the building, changed lights, did the heating and air conditioning, you know. They had other civilians that mopped the floors, you know, like those guys lived in Tonopah or whatever, or in one of the surrounding communities. And you had the civilians, you'd have like from, let's say, Hughes, Martin Marinetta, Lockheed, Grumman, Northrop, all these guys would, you know, had like their own little offices and their own little specific thing to work on. And it was like everybody had a certain piece, and nobody really, the only place you really communicated inside there was in a chow hall or a mess hall or a break room, whatever you want to call it. I mean, that's where, you know, I mean, like the guys from Hughes would talk with the guys from Grumman, you know. I mean, because like any offices, they were separated. They weren't allowed to talk to one another. It was like they had a military office in between them.
Yeah, I was going to ask. So there's civilian contractors, I guess, and military people. Well, who was in charge there? The civilians or the military?
Military.
Okay.
And did you know that? Like, would you be dispatched to the office of the CO for something or another?
First sergeant, mostly. First sergeant, yeah. I might have talked to my commander 3 times in 7 years.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, actually went into his office, you know, where you got to stand at attention and salute him and all that other stuff. Yeah, actually, in his office.
This was not, Viper, this was not the kind of group you thought you didn't volunteer for this.
No. Nobody volunteers for it. If you're military.
What kind of secret or background check do they have to do for you to be lucky enough to get this kind of a gig?
They do what they call an EBI.
Okay.
You've got NCIs, then you got background investigations, and then you've got top secret security clearance investigations, and then you got EBIs.
And what is an EBI?
Extensive background investigation.
And what does that mean, extensive?
That's where they send people back to talk to, like, your first grade teacher. Try to find out if you've ever done drugs. You got to give them 5 friends' names, 5 childhood friends' names, and 5 adult friends' names, and 5 relatives' names. And when they go talk to your friend, they ask for him to give you five names. And then when they go talk to a family member, they go, okay, give me five more family members to talk to. Mm-hmm. And it's like, and then, you know, of course they, you know, do your criminal background, see if you've been, had a DUI or been in an assault or shot anybody or stole anything, whatever.
Well, could you get out of this assignment if you wanted? I mean, if you just
no.
didn't... No?
No. I tried every month to get out.
Oh, really?
How come you tried to get out?
Because I wanted to be an air traffic controller.
Well, that makes perfect sense. So you really didn't get the job you wanted to get.
Well, that plus, like, in my shop, we had... nine civilians and eight military, and our shop supervisor was a civilian, and he was like an old grouchy fart. Mm-hmm. And he had a ninth grade education, was a dropout, so I mean, and he went in the army and got kicked out of the army. He went straight from getting kicked out of the army to getting a job at Nellis, and you know, worked his over his 35-year career, worked his way up to being a supervisor. And to me, I was gung-ho military, and I didn't think I needed to take orders from a civilian. You know, now a sergeant say something to me, or you know, an officer, it was, yes, sir. But civilian was... I just didn't look at him as a military authority, even though he was a civilian boss. And I didn't think that civilians should be allowed in our shops, but you know, the DOD thinks that, you know, we got to have civilians here in case we all go off to war. Somebody's got to take care of the base, so they got to have civilians there too.
And what was this person's job, your supervisor?
He was a mechanical superintendent. He took care of, you know, like electrical, heating, air conditioning, plumbing, all that stuff.
Now, what was your daily job like? A typical day in the life of Viper at Papoose Lake. Regular day.
When there wasn't a crash.
Right. That's what I'm asking.
You would walk in the office and you'd get a list of work orders to go check. Okay, temperature's too hot in room 812. Or room's too hot in B13A. And you'd go in there and you'd take your little hose meter, vacuum meter, and you pop the thermostat off, and you'd set, because when we'd get a call, everybody'd get eight tickets, because you're supposed to do, and it was supposed to take you an hour to check out what was wrong with the problem. Whether it took you 30 seconds to fix it, you were supposed to work on it for an hour. If you didn't work on it for an hour, you weren't doing your job. You know, there was something wrong. You weren't checking enough out. So you'd go, you know, fix the problem. Might take you 10 seconds to a minute, maybe 10 minutes. And so you'd sit in the office and you'd talk with the guys and find out where they're from and how many kids they got and what they were doing and what kind of college education they got. You know, and they'd ask me, are you going to college? And I'd go, yeah, I'm in community college of the Air Force right now. You know, I'm taking electronic engineering and business management. And so you'd just sit there and talk. And then you'd go on to your next call. And you'd go, you'd get it fixed. And then you'd sit and shoot the bull with who was ever working in that lab or that office or whatever.
So now, does crash retrieval come up all of a sudden? Is it sort of like an emergency when you have to do that?
Yep. It was like you never knew if you was leaving work or they'd call you at 4 a.m. and wake your butt out of bed until you get to the base in 30 minutes.
I see. Okay.
Now, where did you live?
At that time.
Yeah.
I lived in Las Vegas.
So
I lived off base because I was married.
Okay, so then they would ship you from whenever you were on duty, you'd have to commute to the base from Las Vegas.
Right.
Can you describe that commute?
Well, if it was local, you'd go but like in a blackened out bus or whatever, depending. You know, now I was on three different bases in my lifetime, so I was at Bergstrom, and I was at Nellis, and I was at Edwards. So, depending on what base you was on, either they would fly you there via C-130, or you'd go on one of these blue buses with blacked out windows. Sometimes the drive would be an hour or two. Sometimes it'd be 8-10 hours. Same thing with the flight.
So when you were at Papoose Lake, how did you get from Las Vegas to Papoose Lake?
Okay, when I was an airman till I'm 84 sergeant, you went by the blue buses, and you went down these gravel roads forever. And then once you made E4, E5, you know, especially staff sergeants and above. But me, like when I got sergeant, we used to fly what they called Janet Air. And the reason they called it Janet Air was because when they first started the flights, the colonel's wife's name was Janet, but they were just a regular 737. They were all white with like red pinstriping and I think red tail on them. Just like the ones that flew into Laughlin the day after that, mm-hmm. what I thought was a meteor crash. But mm-hmm. those flew into Laughlin, and, you know, that day, about 9, 10 o'clock in the morning, because my son-in-law and I was still out fishing in the lagoon. I says, maybe it's a UFO, because there's Janet Air.
How many guys go out on a crash retrieval, approximately?
How long?
How many personnel would go out to retrieve a crash? A UFO crash?
Between 50 and 100. Depends on if the Army was involved.
Okay, and did you ever get a special medal or any kind of jump in pay for this?
Well, you got hazardous duty pay, $175 a month. Like 1 month you'd get it, and next month you wouldn't get it.
Okay, but you didn't get any kind of special secret medals or anything like that, a secret label you would have or anything for your uniform?
No, we got 4 unit presidential unit citations. Does that count?
Yeah, it does. Now, when you were in Laughlin and you saw
because here's the thing. It could be totally life-threatening. You don't know what you're going to find out there. It seems like you really are just asking people to just walk into the unknown here.
Yeah, but when you're in the military, and, okay, because I asked my, he would have been the vice base commander. I asked him, I says, you know, why aren't we getting, like, the Airman's Cross for this? Because I asked about it, and he says, what in your job title?
Mm-hmm.
Or job description mm-hmm. says you deserve any medal for anything you do? You're on an NBC crew.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that doesn't entitle you to get any medals. You know, there's nothing that you can do on an NBC crew that's above and beyond the call of duty. Nothing.
Nothing?
There's nothing you can do.
Yeah, but see, the thing is,
save the colonel's life. There's nothing that you can do that's not in your job description on an NBC crew.
Except it's the whole point of it. Go ahead.
But in an NBC crew, there's no job description of, let's say, walking right into a hand-to-hand combat situation with an alien entity. I mean, it could be unbelievably horrible. And just because it's not in the job description, I mean, you're asking human beings to do very scary stuff here, is all I'm saying. It just seems like when you roll, when they notify you, you don't know what's on the other side of that crash.
Well, it's true, but I mean, when you put on an NBC suit, for example, when you go out and decontaminate a plane or a truck or whatever it is, you know, mm-hmm. it's like when, you know, all the equipment that they used on these recoveries, they'd go out and put them on a certain pad on the runway. And when we get done, we'd have to get back in our MVC suits and we'd go out there. Fire truck would come out and keep us hosed down. Otherwise, inside M suits, get up to like 140 degrees and nothing flat. And of course, in Nevada, you know, it's even worse. But, I mean, you had to go down there and wash all them things off. So, I mean, there's... Being on an NBC crew, you were just like, there's nothing that you could do that, I mean, even saving the president. I mean, you know, look at a Secret Service guy. If he gets shot, should he get a medal for getting shot for saving the president? No, because that's his job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're in the Air Force, that's your job.
Well, I want to ask you this, though. When you were in Laughlin, and this was in, this would have been in 2008, when you saw the object coming over Needles, or toward Needles. Did you, and when you saw the Janet aircraft, do you know where they landed?
Bullhead City.
Bullhead City, in Arizona.
Yeah.
Right in the fork, yeah.
Across the river, yeah. Because we're at standing on the docks fishing, waiting for daylight. It was probably 3:34 in the morning when this thing come whizzing overhead. I mean, it was whistling loud, so we knew it was close. And you know, my son-in-law, him and I went out and fished there all the time because we were going to take the boats out in the lagoon because the trout come in. When the rainbow trout come in, you want to chase them, and so you can get your limit. And if you're chasing them in a little boat, you know, electric, with your electric motor.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, you know, Janet makes this big, long, curved circle. You know, it went to the south and turned back north and landed in Bullhead City. I jokingly told my son-in-law, well, it must have been a UFO, Mike. You know, because we always used to see meteors falling stars, and you could see, like, Skylab or whatever that, Mir space station or
right.
What International Space Station fly over at night and stuff. And you know, I mean, we were both amateur astronomers. We used to take the telescopes out and look at Venus and Mars, and so I know what the difference between a meteor and a
I mean, this is the fastest show I think we've ever done, so I want to get this question.
Yeah, and I've got two Needles questions to ask before
we
get finished.
Put Needles aside. It's kind of dull.
Well, no. Actually, there are two that are important, but go ahead. You ask the questions.
But here's, to my mind, the huge question. Do you feel that there's a threat to us? Do you feel these entities are hostile? This is scary stuff to hear. And yet we've never, as far as I know, been attacked. So what's your feeling about this situation in terms of the safety of humankind, so to speak?
I think they're just watching, observing. I mean, if there were a threat, I mean, they could take you out. I mean, if they wanted this planet, they'd take it. They'd already have it.
Why do you say that?
What do you got that's going to stop them? I mean,
well, lightning.
You yes. Can't shoot them down. Yeah. I mean, yeah, lightning or harp is the only thing that's going to bring them down.
Yeah, and also they're small, so we could they
might be small, but they got to come from somewhere. They ain't got no bathrooms and no food and no water. There got to be a mothership around real close.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's
so.
The way I look at it.
Okay, here are my two questions. I'll fire them off, and then, because I do, okay. The one question is more of a comment. On UFO Hunters, we asked, when we were in Needles, we asked the manager of the Bullhead City Airport specifically, had he ever heard of Janet? And after the ruckus over in Needles, when that object crashed, did he see any Janet airline planes? And he said he didn't know what Janet was, never heard of Janet. As far as he was concerned, no Janet airline plane ever landed in Bullhead City.
Well, so, I would say that maybe he wasn't there at the time the plane landed. But it landed because Mike and I both seen it land.
Okay, so that's one. Two, in the minutes after Riverboat Bob and Frank Costigan saw that glowing blue object land along the side of the Colorado River in Needles, they saw a huge sky crane helicopter and military units retrieve the object and haul it away. Did they know that it was coming?
Yep. Well, that's what my... Well, I'll call him Bill, because his name's not the same as yours, but starts the same way.
Okay.
Works up in Vegas. That's what... He said that they watched it come in, and they notified the National Guard in Kingman. They notified Yuma. And the Vegas guys were already up in the air heading south because they knew the trajectory. They knew where it was going to hit before it hit. So that's why they were there so fast, because, you know, they knew it was coming out of the sky. And when the parachutes didn't open, they knew they had a problem, and they activated everybody immediately. And that's why, you know, they seen the black ones from the Air Force and the ones from Yuma there so fast, and the big sky cranes from Kingman come in so quickly.
Did that satellite have a nuclear reactor on board?
More than likely it did. I think all military satellites have some type of nuclear reactor on board.
In the hours after that satellite came down, there were units, black SUVs. They were heavily armed. Guys in black camouflage outfits, helmets, again, heavily armed, in Needles, talking to people, making their presence known. Do you know who those units might have been?
Man, it would have been, well, like our sister. Like, I would have been on the crew that recovered that aircraft if I would have been in the Air Force. Mm-hmm. And we used to have a sister group made up of LEs and SPs and stuff, that OSIs, that would go and tell these people, you know, keep your mouth shut. And if you don't keep your mouth shut, we'll destroy your life.
What's an LE?
Law enforcement. Air Force law enforcement. It's just under, you go from SP, a security police, then LE. Security police are like the guys that go out and guard the planes. LEs are law enforcement. They're like your local town cops. And then they jump up from there to OSI. That's like your criminal investigation units.
That's the Office of Special Investigations?
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're they're the ones that intervened in the RAF Bentwaters in 1980. Okay, so and they would come in armed into civilian areas with armed units.
Oh yeah. Yep. I'm sure they did.
Did they would they be badged? Would they be carrying badges?
No. Not allowed to carry ID.
Okay.
Like, we had to take all our patches off whenever we went on an NBC mission. The only thing you carried was, like, your rank on your hat. That was it.
In, how long was there, how far back do the NBC units go? I mean, when do you think they were started? Do you know?
50s.
In the 50s. So that in 1965... in Kecksburg, Pennsylvania, when a very similar object came down, would an NBC unit be dispatched to retrieve that?
Yeah, that would have been an Army NBC, though.
Army NBC.
Yeah, okay. They were closest. Who's ever closest gets there first. Like, the one out in West Texas we retrieved was just, I mean, we could see the fence line of Fort Bliss from where we recovered this object. And Army was already there, but it was like the Air Force's job to pick it up and take it. You know, I don't know who in the government says the Air Force gets to tear this stuff apart and figure out how it works, but that's the Air Force's job.
Well, now, let me ask a question about the present day. In our little world of UFO-dom, there's a very rich guy, his name is Bob Bigelow, and he is trying to build stuff, you know, satellites, stuff like, or not satellites, but, you know, he's trying to work on propulsion systems according to what the lore is. Do you think that people like that, wealthy people, are in the loop on this technology? That's why I was asking about the civilian, who the civilians are at the sites. What do you think? Where do you think the information about how these things run is going? Who has that information?
Martin Marinetta, Hughes, Grumman, Northrop, Lockheed. If they've got anything to do with them, or if they've hired any of their engineers, I've never heard of Bob Bigelow, but does Bob Lazar work for him?
Well, Bob Lazar is a fellow back in the day, but see, what I'm saying is, if you are paid military, you know, our tax dollars pay for you to go out there and risk your life, the information that you're retrieving should belong to all the American people, it would seem, not to industry. You know, I'm just, you know, just wondering where all this fabulous information, I mean, if, you know, since, or put it another way, why do you think this is all hidden from the American people? Besides, forget the religious part and the chaos part, just in terms of the American science community.
Why is it kept from American science community?
Yeah.
You know, wouldn't this be the sort of thing that our top scientists all around the world should be studying, not just...
They're working at Groom Lake, they're working at Edwards, they're working at Papoose Lake.
Okay.
You know, they're working up there in New Mexico and Oak Ridge and that already. Don't you think the top scientists work there already?
Well, I don't know whether the top scientists work, but the top, let's just say the top money, the top moneyed corporations, but not necessarily maybe the smartest people on the planet. Maybe the people have the best, you know. In other words, I'm fearful that this information only goes to the highest bidder, is really where I was going with that question. And it seems like maybe, I don't know, I just find it astounding that this sort of, you seem to know so much and have lived such an interesting life, not as interesting as air traffic control, I grant you, but it just seems a shame that the world goes to sleep every night and not knowing this is going on.
Well, in the academic community, I don't know what percentage of them believe it, and I don't know what percentage would believe it if you showed it to them. I don't know.
Well, I
out
think
of 100 people, if I took them into to Papoose Lake and I took them in and showed them them nine hangars, how many would believe what was in them hangars?
Well, I think
and when you left, how many would say, okay, I now believe in UFOs?
Well, no, I think everybody would.
And then the other 20% say, oh, no, that's something that Lockheed built. That's the aero car, or that's something, you know, Bombardier used to make, or something like that. It's like Kevin on your guys' show. I love his skepticism, but to me, you know, had he joined the military and used his mechanical engineering degree and got shipped to Papoose Lake or Groom Lake or Edwards, where he got introduced into these things, then maybe he wouldn't be so skeptical.
You know? Well, also, and the bodies, do you know anything about what happens to the bodies? Are they studied? Are they stored away someplace for further study?
That's all I know is they go to New York.
Mm-hmm.
That's all.
Can you describe the atmosphere in terms of, were people afraid? Was it business as usual at Papoose Lake? Like, in a run-of-the-mill operation, bringing in a craft or something. Then I want to ask you a quick question about Bob Lazar, but what was the atmosphere like at Papoose Lake among the enlisted personnel or the officers or even some of the civilians that you knew?
It was exciting. I mean, it was, everybody was like hyped up, you know, what new are we going to find out, you know, what makes this work? You know, it's like when you're a little kid and you get a Tinker toy set or you get Legos, you know. How can we build this? How can we tear this apart and put it back together? How can we make it work? I mean, it was an electrifying atmosphere. Everybody was, like, loved their job. Everybody wanted to just get their hands and feet in it 100%.
Well, now, yeah, I was going to ask about that. In the course of your being there, did you ever have anything like, you know, supposedly Tang got invented for the astronauts. Did you guys ever have anything out of this world that was common there that you all used that the American public doesn't have? That's one question. But the other question is, has anybody ever taken any bits and pieces from these crashes and put it in their pockets?
You can try like I did, but when you get caught, you lose a stripe. I'm sure there's a lot of souvenirs out there.
Well, do you think that the souvenirs could be... in other words, do you think that if someone studied the souvenirs, they could tell it's not made here? Or do you think that you kind of can't tell unless you know what you're looking for?
Okay, who's gonna be the person that tells you it wasn't made here? Okay, you can send it to 10 different labs, get 10 results. All 10 of them look the same, but, you know, who's going to say it was made here?
Yeah, I understand what you're saying.
You know, I don't know. They look like aluminum, feel like aluminum, but they're too lightweight to be aluminum, but they look like polished stainless steel. Mm-hmm. And if you've ever seen polished stainless steel, it's very, very heavy. You know, I mean, even a thick piece of aluminum's heavy. You know, an ingot of aluminum's heavy. So,
since you've left the service and been a civilian or just been a person wandering through the world, have you ever seen anything in the outside world that you say to yourself, "Geez, boy, that looks real familiar. I think I might have picked that up, you know, 20 years ago." You know, what is?
It just seems like being at Groom Lake, the technology there, you know, we're getting now. You know, for example, look at the carbon fiber that, you know, when I first got there, the big secrecy there was the 117, and then a couple years later was the B2. And then now they're into the pulse engine aircraft. I mean, you look at the technology from the 117. Now look at the Navy. The Navy's building their ships out of the same thing that, you know, the Air Force flies their planes with. Look at the race cars now. You know, all your high-performance sports cars now all have carbon fiber in them and stuff.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. And I was thinking about Apple technology or titanium or something like that.
You know, to me, it's awfully funny. You get a government group like NASA that, hands somebody like Intel, you know, says, "Here, we want you to build this little transistor, or this little diode, or this microchip, and this is how we want you to build it. And this is, you know, the parameters you get to build it." They give them the plans to build it. And then all of a sudden, you know, Intel goes from a nowhere company to this mega billion corporation overnight for building, you know, a chip. And then you get another company that's super rich for building the diodes, another company that's super rich for building these tiny transistors. I mean, how come all these companies just exploded from, you know, NASA, you know, saying, "Hey, we don't need these big heavy electric switches in here. We want something that's a quarter inch long." And, you know, where'd they get the idea that, you know, Uncle Sam's or NASA ships them the paperwork, ships them the designs, everything else, and NASA says, you guys design it, build it, keep the patents for it, and ship it back to us. Mm-hmm. I mean, how's that supposed to go? Is that fair to everybody in the world? No.
Well, it certainly is fair to the companies, more than fair to the ones who get the material. Tell me about Bob Lazar, Viper. You brought up his name. What did you know about him?
All the guys that worked on the electrical engineers or the mechanical engineers or the metallurgists, the guys in the shop, we used to call them the freaks, because, you know, freaks and geeks go together, you know, but instead of geeks working on computers, they were working on the freaky stuff, and we used to always call, you know, like the F-117 was a wobbly goblin, and the B-2 was the bat, and the stuff we picked up was freaky stuff, mm-hmm. because we didn't know where it come from, we didn't care where it come from, it was just freaky, so the people that worked on it were called the freaks, and okay. He was one of the freaks that worked on it.
Did you see him there?
I seen somebody who looked like him, but I personally did not know Bob was there.
Okay.
I mean, from photos I've seen of him, yeah, but he's got like, he put out like a picture of this, of what the inside of Papoose like looked like.
Yeah.
Which was a pretty good rendering, and he showed it, you know, how each bay had a aircraft or whatever. But he said, no, this one is the one where a missile went through it, but it wasn't a missile. That one got hit by lightning. And that was one of the ones that we picked up. And that one was in Bay 9. And that's the one we picked up in New Mexico.
The Bob Lazar talked about a certain element called Element 115. And he described this incredible scene where he's looking through a room and somebody tells him, watch a candle flickering in the room. And the candle stops flickering. And you wonder what froze the candle. And the implication was that whatever it was that made the candle stop moving simply slowed down time, or actually stopped time. Did you ever hear of an element 115 or something like that?
No, but I heard of stopping time. But I didn't know it was called 115.
How did you hear about them stopping time?
From one of the offices I was in when I was, after I adjusted, there was this heavy set guy. He couldn't be in his office unless it was like 62 degrees. He worked for, he'd come out of Edwards. He worked for Lockheed. And, he had told me about it. We ended up being very good friends until he passed away here.
What did he tell you about it? Can you remember exactly what he said?
He just says, we know how to stop time. That's all. Well, but wasn't a project he was working. He was actually working on what he called the magnetic engines. Mm-hmm. He said they were like big magnets inside. But they were like anti-gravity engines, because when you energized them, whatever created a gravity or magnetic effect, these engines opposed it and would push away the other way. And that's why the craft were, you know, could go from 0 to 9,000 in 3.1 seconds or faster. You know, just how they can, you know, we ain't got nothing like that.
Did anybody ever explain how these things managed to overcome things like friction, air resistance, things like that?
No.
I mean, that kind of G-force going from, let's say, hovering to, you know, Mach 5 in a matter of seconds would be an incredible G-force.
Yeah, I mean, you got, you look like a F-16 pilot's now. That they got that positive oxygen ventilation system that they wear. They can do 11, 12 G turns now. You know, where air is actually forced into their lungs. you know, and keep their lungs expanded, they can actually run, you know. And what's the plane capable of, what, 14 G's?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's nothing like the 200 or 300 G's these spacecraft do, but I don't know. There, I'd have to say that they're I don't know, how would you put it? If you're inside one, you don't have that gravitational force pulling on you.
So in other words, it's in kind of an envelope or a bubble?
Yep.
Yep.
That's the best way I could explain it.
Okay. Well, good.
It's the only way I could explain it.
I just wanted we've only got a few more minutes left, and I just wanted to find out, Viper, you're retired now, I take it, right?
Right.
And are you medically retired as well?
Yes, 100%.
Okay, what kind of hobbies? What do you do these days what do you do for fun?
Fish and woodwork, play with my grandkids.
Cool, okay.
Okay.
Are you planning on telling them what you've told us, basically, if they ask?
If they was to ask?
Yeah, in other words, do you feel that this is information that they should know, just as, you know, family members or members of your family? In other words, I'm still concerned about your safety and health if you're telling us this stuff, is really, you know, what I'm wondering.
Well, I've already been warned once by them.
Okay.
I was in the hospital in Sioux Falls lately. I had some guys come talk to me and tell me I was going to lose my VA benefits if I talked about it in the hospital anymore. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this is the first time in, 15 years I've publicly talked about it. So, I mean, people around me know that I believe in UFOs only because, you know, I've seen them.
You can
believe in them and not believe them. It's up to you.
Well, you know, you said something very intriguing. You dropped a little hint when you said that you actually tried to keep a piece of what you were retrieving.
Right.
And you lost a stripe.
Yeah.
How did you try to keep the piece, and how did they find out? And tell us that quick story.
I don't know, we was just out there picking up pieces, and there was this little piece about an inch and a half long and about an inch wide, and it had these weird markings on it, and I thought, you know, it looked like a structural beam to me, kind of like an I-beam type thing. I just picked it up and put it in my pocket, and somebody seen me put it in my pocket, and when I went to get on the bus, the captain was holding his hand out and says, "Can I have that piece of metal you picked up?"
Well.
And I handed it to him, and I wasn't a staff sergeant no more. I was a sergeant.
Did you ever get your stripe back?
No.
Well.
Got out as an E-4.
That's depressing.
Yeah, it is depressing. Well, I want to do a couple of things. One, we are going to send this to Tom Carey, Air Force officer, Kevin Randall. And what I'm hoping is, and I'm also going to send it to George Knapp, and what I'm hoping is that...
So I was right about Tom Carey.
Yes. And what I'm hoping is that if they would love to have a Q&A with you, you could come back on the air and basically, you know, we'd do it the same way. Obviously, nobody's going to know what your real identity is, where you are. And basically, I know that they're going to have more specific Air Force-related questions than I can ask, simply because I wasn't in the Air Force. So what I'm hoping is that you can come back and do a story with us on UFO Magazine or something like that. But that's in the future. That's, you know, weeks in the future.
Just give me a couple weeks' notice, so
great.
I can come here.
Well, I do appreciate your... I think you don't sound like you are easily shaken, but I think you must be the bravest man in the world, so I do appreciate what you're saying and doing.
No, trust me, back then I was... scared to death because it was just back then you were in the unknown, and plus being in the service, you know, when you want to hold on to your stripes and feed your family, you're done as you're told. You know, you don't question what you're told. You know, people ask you, well, why would you do something crazy like that? It's because you was told to do it. You know, you were ordered to do it, and you did what you were ordered to do.
Right.
You know, it's not because I was brave or I was nuts or whatever. It was just something that you did because you were told to do it, and you was in the service, and that was part of being in the service, was following orders.
What are your ailments right now? Are they military? Are they work related? Do you think?
They have me as the VA or my service connection disability. I'm on. You know, I give my government pension every month is due to a skin condition, and I do get rashes from the groin down, and they send me salve out monthly. This new stuff they sent out doesn't work very good. I want the old stuff back. But it's like my doctors, they, you know, that's all they can do is get this salve for me.
Well, have you told your doctors about the NBC unit that you were part of?
Yeah.
And they
requested my records, and they were told, just treat him and don't worry about what he did in the Air Force.
Okay.
And my doctor, I sat in my doctor's office while he argued with him, said, look, I got to know what this guy was exposed to. How am I supposed to treat him if I don't know what he's exposed to? And, you know, it's like the civilians back in the 90s that were dying left and right. They all filed lawsuits, and stupid Clinton, you know, says, oh, well, Groom Lake's top secret. You know, we can't, you know, let information out. And, you know, a lot of chemicals they had there that were weird. They burned a lot of stuff there that was weird.
Have you kept in touch with any of your any of the guys you went out on these crash retrievals with?
Yeah, that's the ones that still live in Las Vegas, too, yeah.
And are any of them sick as well?
Yeah. We all have the same ailments. Charlie's got, he's worse than me. He's been through, I don't know, he's had like 3 or 4 cancer chemo treatment things. He gets these nasty, I don't know, they call it Agent Orange syndrome. You know, it's like the guys that come from Vietnam, you know, it's pretty much same symptoms, the big sores, the rashes, the, you know, you can't sleep at night, the night sweats.
Were you unhealthy when you went into the Army or to the Air Force?
No, I was healthy. I was like a rock. I played football, baseball, basketball.
So you weren't sickly?
Oh, no, I run 20 miles.
Have you been to VA centers to try and get help for your skin rashes and things like that?
Yeah, they sent me all over the country. I've been in the one in Tampa Bay, right across from University of Southern Florida. I've been to the one in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. I've been to the one in Minneapolis, Minnesota, that's right there by the University of Minnesota Medical Center. Like the one there, all the docs there that worked on me were all specialists from the Mayo Clinic. I guess they got a Mayo Clinic there next door. They were all specialists. I've been out to California, and so, but now I go back to Vegas when I'm in town. I go up to Vegas every 4 months. I go to Vegas for treatment.
Did you ever suffer from radiation poisoning?
Well, my badge never, you know, changed colors, or I never was called into the office for, you know, my badge being too radioactive. But I don't know. I look at the radiation symptoms and stuff. Of course, back then they used to give us iodine pills all the time. So,
right.
You know, that might have kept the radiation sickness away or down or whatever. You know, it's like the guys in Iraq or Iran, you know, they give them all them weird pills, and if they're not affected to it, they get sick, and if they are affected, they're fine. Mm. But, you know, Army and Air Force is weird that way. They like to medicate you whether you want it or not.
Well, I thank you. We do thank you very, very much. We've had an amazing response in the chat room. I think everybody's questions have been answered. And it's just gripping. And I think you're an American hero.
And we're going to ask you back. I want to, you know, get you either on the air with Kevin and or George or Tom Carey, but at least, or funnel their questions to you, and let's see if we can set something up. And you'll have certainly more than a few weeks' notice.
Okay. You guys got a chat room?
Oh yeah,
there's a chat room. They don't know you. They don't know who you are.
Oh no, I didn't even know you had a forum or anything like that.
Yeah, basically, if you go on futuretheater.com, all the links take you to the chat room, and in fact, you can go there now and just kind of scroll up and watch the. You can read backwards, scroll up and read backwards. Basically, go to futuretheater.com or go to Inception Radio Network or InceptionRadio.com, and at the top is the chat. And the show's going to be repeated. It's live right now, but it's going to be repeated at 10. So during the 10 o'clock show, there'll be probably more people. So Viper, if you're around, you might want to show up in the chat and say hi. People will freak out at the thought of it. It'd be fun. And
okay. Well, I got Inception Radio up.
Yeah, Inception Radio. You go there, and then at the top of the Inception Radio screen, you'll see Listen Live and Chat. And that's where the chat people are. And there's really good. There's other radio folk in the chat. Angela Joyner, she's a sort of a famous reporter at this point, etc. And other people are in here too. Other people who don't use their real name. There's just a few who use their real name. My pal Al Lindbergh is in here. Bob Tarmac. That's not. Well, that's we know him as Bob Tarmac, etc. So anyway, so yeah. But people are here, and you know, I'm sure we'd love to talk to you. And I do so appreciate it. As I said, you know, I'll calm down in about 5 hours.
Well, if you're worried about them being, I mean, I'm not one of these that believe that they're hostile.
No, I'm worried about the American government coming and knowing this information. You know,
I'd be. About them trying to shut down your show, then shut me down.
Yeah, and shut down my life. You know, I don't want that either. I hate that.
It's too late now. You know, that's like after the fact. But yeah, I mean, okay, so we're going to sign off now. We will follow up with this. Viper, thank you for being here. And to everybody, please join the chat, answer some questions, and to everybody out there, our chat room, folks listening, folks who will be listening, thank you. I'm going to be in Los Angeles next week, but I'll be back for the week after next, and we will see you on the air. Have a wonderful weekend. Hope the wind dies down. Have a wonderful weekend, and I will see you on the radio in 2 weeks, and from Bill and Nancy Burns from Primrose Creek in beautiful downtown Solbury. Have a wonderful evening.
Thank you.
Thank you, Viper.
Thank you, Bill.
have some fun. Maybe get a little bit of insight. Get a lay of the land. Want to know what's really going on? Do what I do. Listen to Future Theater. It airs every Saturday, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, on the InceptionRadioNetwork.com. We'll see you there.
Are you tired of listening to the same old talk radio? Then tune in to the Joyner Report every Thursday night at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time with Angela Joyner for some thought-provoking conversation. The Joyner Report on the Inception Radio Network every Thursday night at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time.